So this session today, just to let you know a little bit more about who I am besides the resume, you know, I am the daughter of two faculty members, two professors at Louisiana State University. Up until last year, they both retired. I have been throughout my career sort of pigeonholed or framed, as you might say, as a member of Generation Y. So my first book, Generation Debt, was all about the student loan crisis and the issues that we're seeing so much of in the news now with the Occupy Wall Street movement. And my bias, therefore, has been on the roles and the needs of students within higher education. I understand they're just one part of the ecosystem, but I do have the bias that students are the reason that higher education exists. And then finally, I'm a journalist, which means two things. It means I ask questions. So, you know, the frameworks and the ideas and the models that I'm presenting here are not finished, or they're not, you know, meant to be directives, but they're really meant to be a means of opening up the conversation a little bit more. I don't position myself as an expert in higher education, but as someone who has been covering it and talking to the experts and trying to figure out what might happen next. The other salient fact about being a journalist is that I'm very familiar with what happens when digital media and new business models disrupt an industry. That's the story of my career so far, and it's something that I can relate to a lot, and I think there's a lot of legitimate fears and questions that arise about what values do we want to preserve and what things have to be given up as we march toward this kind of brave new future. The reality from students' point of view, right? Two-thirds of students, up from less than half of them in 1993, are graduating with student loans. That's for the ones that graduate. And 27,000 is the average of those that loan burden when you take PLUS loans into account. And the default rate has been jumping over the last few years. And all of this is very, very relevant to the way that students see their educations and the value of their educations. It's very, very hard to get away from a commodified vision of education when the cost is so darn high. So again, this is a slide taken from the We Are the 99% Tumblr. If you go up there, you just see dozens and dozens of young people putting up signs where they talk about, you know, I'm 24 years old, I have my bachelor's degree, I have $70,000 in debt, I can barely afford to pay rent, buy groceries. This is the economic situation that young people find themselves in, particularly those who took advantage of a higher education. I mean, it's, you know, there's still a payoff to a degree, there's still a vast gulf between the earnings of those with degrees and without them, but it's the ones who have their degrees and have a lot of debt and haven't been able to find satisfying jobs that are really calling a nationwide referendum on the value of higher education. And, you know, these are quotes that I've gotten from students recently that I've interviewed about this topic, that this is really top of mind for them, and they are being asked to make that connection and are making that connection for themselves between their degrees and what's going to happen when they get out. And, you know, it's not just about this individual economic cycle that we're in right now. It's about preparing for a world of global competition and needing to prepare for you know, jobs that may be outsourced, industries that may go overseas, as well as this idea that I think even more challenging in some ways to the models that we've based ourselves on in higher education, saying that you can, you know, we can no longer predict, in other words, exactly what it is that our students need to know. There's no a possibility for central planning of things like curriculum very tightly because of this issue of industries evolving and new opportunities arising that are not able to be foreseen. And so it seems to me that, well, you know, what this kind of fact is cited by Kathy Davidson in her most recent book, she's at Duke University, that, you know, a majority of students now in grade school are going to be employed in an industry that does not exist today. You know, that really begs the question of, well, if we just think about it as a predetermined set of skills that our students need, or predetermined areas of knowledge that they need to absorb, that's not quite going to cut it, right? So these issues, the issue of cost, and of course the issue of access that comes with that, you know, in DOAU I go into the decline of education as a engine of social mobility in American society, that the dumbest rich kids are more likely to go to college than the smartest poor kids. And then, of course, this relevance question, you know, is the way that our students are learning, is it relevant to either the global competition that they're facing or the sort of future shock issues that they're facing. All of these constitute, very briefly, the case for radical innovation in higher ed. And, you know, that's the case that I lay out. You know, I say, you know, we can argue about the merits of this innovation or that innovation, but what we can't argue about is that what we have right now is not going to be sustainable. So one framework that I think is interesting for thinking about what radical innovation might look like, again, goes back to this cost question. So, you know, I think that cost is key to the way that students are seeing their education and the purpose of their education and the value of it. And cost is likewise key, I think, to seeing how the solutions might work. So how many of you here are familiar with Baumol's cost disease? It's so interesting. No matter how many times I talk about this, it's like, no. William Baumol and William Bowen, 1966, economists at Princeton, one of them later was a president of Princeton, published the paper Performing Arts, the Economic Dilemma. And they had, you know, in the 1960s, America was already experiencing the first flush of real innovation through technology and automation that was bringing down the cost of so many goods and even services across the spectrum. So this was, you know, the age of domestic innovation, those people who watch Mad Men, you know, the housewives, time-saving devices, and all these things. But there seemed to be certain industries, certain areas in the economy that were immune to this kind of innovation. And Baumol and Bowen used the example of a string quartet. They said, you know, if you want a string quartet, if you want to save money on a string quartet, well, you can't, what can you do? You can't cut the cello player. You can't play the Mozart any faster. You're not going to save any time by, you know, Taylorism and by putting things on an assembly line. You have to play it at the speed that is written. And finally, you know, for us today, you would say you can't actually put the string quartet in China if you want to have a live concert in Philadelphia. So they concluded from this that there are certain areas of the economy that are highly dependent on very intensively skilled labor. So it's intensive, it's labor intensive, and that labor is skilled labor. And therefore, it's going to rise faster than inflation always, because the cost of labor rises faster than the cost of goods. And they later extended this conclusion from the performing arts to education and actually to healthcare, which we do see education and healthcare specifically being the two areas in our economy that are defiant to inflation. And higher education tuition specifically growing more than any other good or service in the entire U.S. economy since 1978. What does this have to do with reinvention? What does it have to do with innovation? Well, there's another major area where economics turns out to be key to thinking about how things change. So how many people here are familiar with Moore's Law? Ah, okay, I see the audience. Right, so Moore's Law is this magical little device that has allowed us to enjoy the benefits of palm-top computing and instantaneous transmutation and augmented reality. It basically dictates that chips are going to get smaller and they're going to get faster, doubling both of that every 18 months, let's say. What I did not realize until I looked up the original paper, which is up here, is how much Gordon Moore was focused on economics, right? So if you see right in the subtitle of this paper, he says, with unit cost falling as the number of components per circuit rises, by 1975, economics may dictate squeezing as many as 65,000 components on a single silicon chip. What does it mean to say that economics dictates innovation? We're used to thinking of economics as the enemy of innovation, right? Money constraints, time constraints, this stops us from being free thinkers and you know, spinning out kind of these wonderful scenarios where we realize, you know, what might be totally different from what we have today. And it's definitely true that in the area of pure research, you know, there's a time to kind of shut the door on the guys in the lab and let them come up with the craziest thing they can. But when it comes to the kind of innovation that we all enjoy in the world of technology, when we start applying things, it's really, really key that economics be part of the equation. And I really think that that's something that has to come to higher education. You know, we talk about IT and all the wonderful things that IT can do for education. If you don't apply economics to that, because what does economics mean? Economic doesn't mean that you're commodifying education. It means that you're taking it back down to this question of What are students getting? What's the value of what they're getting? Is it accessible enough? Because the key to social mobility in America is access to higher education for all who are qualified to participate. And the key to that access is cost. So without combining the two forces of innovation and cost cutting, I don't really see how we get to a future of education that most of us in this room would like to see. So what could that possibly mean? I talk about a lot of different areas in DIYU, a lot of different models and experiments that people are trying. I think one of the key moves that's happening is that the monolithic university is evolving toward many, many little different types of things. And you might think of it as, you know, maybe it's the death of the dinosaurs and the birth of the age of the mammals, or highly, you know, high diversity rather than a few very dominant models. Not that I'm saying any of you work for dinosaurs, but... so we're talking about, you know, the different buckets of benefit or value that higher education provides and how each of these buckets might start to be delivered differently under a DIY type of future, or actually present, as John mentioned, you know, how these benefits might be able to be delivered in a way that is more lightweight, perhaps of lower cost, and ultimately of higher value to the students. And just for convenience, I break these down into content, socialization, and accreditation. So if you ask students why it is that they go to college, they tend to give you these reasons in reverse order, right? First they say, I'm in college to get a good job. Then if you prod them a little bit, they say, oh, and I'm also here, you know, to learn about myself, leadership roles, to create relationships with my peers, perhaps find a mentor and, you know, grow up a little bit. And then then there's a silence, and then you say, well, what about learning? And they say, oh, yes, 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 I'm here to get skills and knowledge. Yeah, that's you. So all of these are changing. All of these are evolving. Probably most of the people here in this room are very familiar with the open educational content movement, open educational resources, starting with MIT in 2001, putting all of their courses online. The Open Courseware Consortium, of course, with 200 institutions in 100 countries, putting many, many, many resources online. And this is kind of changing the conversation because it opens up the classroom. It dethrones the lecturing professor as being the main paradigm of what college experience is supposed to be. Because as we can see, you know, if you put the best lecturers in the world who are available anytime, any place for free, if you put those up against the lecturers that happen to be at your school that only lecture at 8 a.m., then students are going to vote with their feet, right? So that's kind of what we see happening here. And we see that college classes that are based on a frontal disgorgement of knowledge onto students are less compelling, perhaps, when compared with the explosion of resources that are online. You know, obviously these resources are continuously updated. They have the potential to be more relevant, perhaps more accessible to students than the traditional textbook, the traditional lecture. And we all have kind of sampled these benefits. I would argue that, you know, the openness in open educational content is being a little bit lost. David Wiley, who's one of the originators of the Creative Commons license and the first open content license for open education, has talked about open washing. And he said, you know, a lot of people are using this word open, and it doesn't always mean what they think it means. You know, if the stuff that you're using isn't free, isn't actually open licensed, if there's restrictions on sharing it and reusing it, then there are some potential problems, I think, with adoption of it and ultimately down the road with the public mission of education. In order for open content to really realize the cost lowering, I think that, you know, the low-hanging fruit there is obviously in textbooks, in the open license textbooks, that can save students. You know, students are spending now $1,000 a year on textbooks. So for community college students, that's as much as their tuition. So there's two paths ahead of us in open content. There is federally funded, publicly available, open licensed content that's shared and reused amongst universities, where professors actually save time because they're not preparing the same lecture over and over again, but they're using openly available resources. And then there's things that are called open that might be free because they're ad supported, or they're free, you know, within a certain commercial framework, but they don't actually save any money, Yeah, I think a lot of open, you know, so-called open by traditional publishers, tablet-based textbooks and that kind of thing. It looks like openness, but it's not really going to save you any money in the long run because it's still within the traditional commercial framework. So openness kind of a, you know, what I'd say about OER has changed a little bit because it's everybody has kind of seized on this idea and it's going off in so many different directions. And then, of course, the other challenge of open content is that education is not just about content. And this is a point that is made over and over again, needs to be made over and over again. When I finish talking today, someone's going to stand up and say, you know, education is not just content. It's there, right? This is really important. We know this. If you have an educational model, however, that's going on in your universities that pretty much feels like content, then, you know, it doesn't emphasize the interaction, it doesn't emphasize the socialization aspect, then students are going to have a hard time seeing what the difference really is. So, you know, this is something that a student I was talking to at a small private university, which is renowned for its community, he's kind of thinking out loud, and he says, you know, if this stuff is out there for free, why am I spending $50,000 a year? Well, I want that support network, right? And I think a great way to think about this is the digital music revolution, right? So people are not paying money for records anymore, or CDs. There's no more Tower Records in the middle of Greenwich Village. It's very sad. What they are paying money for and what musicians are making their money from is concerts, the live experience. Being there in a room with that inimitable feeling of being with other people that are just as excited as you are, and that experience of connecting to a performer, the performer's connecting to the crowd, people are willing to pay for that. Young people are willing to pay for that. And I think in thinking about the ways that the content, you know, can transform higher education, connecting this cost issue with this innovation issue, we have to think about how are we redeploying our resources away from a content-based, you know, we're selling certain units of knowledge to this rock concert feeling where what we're creating on our campuses, if you choose to invest in your campus, of course, that's not the only option, but if you choose to invest in your campus and in a residential experience and all of that wonderful stuff, how great is it for students to be there? How exciting is it? How much do they want to be there just to be with other people? And how much are you using your classroom time actually to foster that kind of connection? Of course, socialization doesn't always happen in person. And I think one of the most interesting directions that socialization is taking with learning is in this world of personal learning networks, right? Very simply, just this idea of students learning from each other online, of building resources, and of foregrounding the peer experience in learning. And there's a lot of reasons for this. There's a lot of research about the wonderful nature of peer learning and how peer learning helps, you know, the tutor and the tutee and helps people arrive at a better version of the truth. It improves collaboration skills. I'm just testing this right here. Okay. You know, students are participating in these kinds of things spontaneously. These are a couple of examples from a group of students who are in a very small private, you know, graduate program together, which uses a version of, I think, I'm going to say Sakai, although I don't, please don't quote me on that. They have a learning management system, but it's not optimized for collaboration. And so they're using workarounds. They're using things like Dropbox to share and collaborate on the best notes. They're using Facebook as a spontaneous platform for study sessions and group networks where people, if they can't show up at the study session, they post questions and answer each other's questions. The professors don't know anything about this. I just, you know, ask them about what they're doing, and this is what came up. We're not always providing these affordances in our learning management systems, and not every student is savvy enough or capable enough to figure this out. You also need to design assessment programs that encourage collaboration and encourage peer learning. You know, a very key thing about this program was that the students were not graded on a curve. So they are, you know, it's not a zero-sum game, therefore they're much more willing to collaborate and share the best notes and so forth. So peer learning is important because it improves learning. Peer learning is important because it simulates the kind of collaboration and creativity that students are going to have to do out in the working world if they're going to optimally participate. And peer learning can, in some cases, lower some of the cost of instruction because the participation grading and the actual hands-on time that it takes. And people know this. I mean, the whole idea of increasing class size is a very basic and old way of lowering costs in learning. But it's one thing to have increasing class size and have everybody be sitting frontally and just looking at the teacher versus breaking them off into discussion groups and making them responsible for participating and asking each other questions and even getting them involved in assessment. And I mean, this is probably the biggest example of this that's going on right now, the massively open online course at Stanford University. Massively open online courses, of course, were originated earlier this decade by a couple of different professors online. But now that it's at Stanford, it's front page news in the New York Times. Combination of Google Moderator, which is a tool for voting up questions in a group, very large group, and other AI, artificial intelligence technologies to try to actually even help automate assessment. These are ways of solving the problems or sort of getting into what it actually might mean to have 100,000 students in a single course. Very, very intriguing stuff. Yet another example of the network and how the network can come into teaching and learning and actually have a role in assessment beyond the peers that are in an individual institution and learning community. This experiment of Wikipedia and learning is basically the idea of assigning students, instead of writing a research paper that goes to that is read by the professor and no one else, have them write a Wikipedia article, which has to be footnoted and have primary sources in it. Not individual reporting, but it has to have links out. And this was done as an experiment by the Wikimedia Foundation, tried in 45 different classes where, everything from science to history to literature, having students write Wikipedia entries that are then voted up and improved by the network. And, a really incredible experience, I think, for students who are able to participate in this way, something that professors as scholars have the experience of getting their findings looked at and peer-reviewed. But students, we know, basically are writing for an audience of one or an audience of two, and it's very, very difficult to translate that experience into the experience they have in the real world, where if they do writing, it's usually for an audience greater than that, hopefully. It's usually for a purpose. And they have to be able and willing to create a presence online as well and have things be recognized by a network. And all of this, Wikipedia kind of provides a very easy to use portal for students to be able to do this. So what do we think now about the possibilities for open accreditation? I think this is probably one of the most interesting, challenging aspects of the transformations that we're seeing in education. But ultimately one of the most promising as well, particularly for institutions that have a lot of sunk costs involved and a lot of expertise in this whole realm of education. So, John and I were talking before, right before I went on stage, and he said, like he said to you guys, we've got these students, they're science and math and engineering students, they go and do Khan Academy, and then they just come for the exam, and they wonder why, they should be paying full tuition just to be, if they're learning on their own, why can't they just get that credit another way, right? And I think that that's something we're increasingly going to be seeing, and I think that's something that institutions need to be willing and able to adapt to. The fact is that students are going to be following more idiosyncratic and complex learning paths. Right now they're doing it out of necessity, right? Right now the average student is not a traditional student. They're older, they're in their mid-20s. 60% of them have more than one institution on their transcript by the time they graduate. Only 56% of students who start a four-year program finish that program within 6 years. The number is much, much lower for those who start a two-year program after 3 years. So the time to degree is lengthening, the stopouts and the dropouts are changing a lot. Students have work responsibilities, they have home responsibilities. And, I use the term edupunk advisedly. I use it for learners who are not fitting the traditional educational mold. And there's lots of reasons why learners might not fit the traditional educational mold. And I posit that the responsibility and the onus is on institutions, if they wish to remain relevant, to fit themselves to these students' paths and not the other way around. So, you know, what does that mean in practice, right? Students are following these personal learning paths. One possibility is that institutions specialize in assessing their paths. Empire State College is, you know, part of the SUNY system, and they have, since the 1970s, a focus on basically helping students write personal learning plans, helping them knit together their life experience and their interests and their goals into something that's coherent, something that matches up with the expectations of an institution and an accreditor for what constitutes a bachelor's degree. And a very key component in making this happen is portfolio-based assessment, prior learning assessment, right? So the learning that we all do out there in the world, so much of, and you know, the internet did not invent self-learning, it did not invent open learning. There have always been autodidacts, there have always been people taking advantage of resources to learn. It's just that the possibilities for that have exploded, and it's concurrently made visible how much learning we're all doing every day of our lives. And what's missing is the ability then to turn that into something that you can put on a transcript, show to an employer, communicate to a community about. Portfolio-based assessment is something I delved in a little bit for the EduPunk's Guide. I have an article about it in the recent issue of Change magazine, and I'm really bullish on it. I think, you know, it's not a new idea. It's 30, 40 years old, but the idea that you write a narrative of your learning, you bolster it with references and demonstrations of the learning, not only does it require, result in some credits on your transcript, which help you get through college faster. It's been shown, you can save money getting through college this way. It makes people more likely to be successful in college. And part of that is because of the soft skills, the so-called soft skills, that come out of a portfolio, participating in a portfolio program. You reflect on your own learning. You reflect on your learning style. You do metacognition. You put your learning in practice, in the context of your life history, and you create a whole narrative around it. This is something that, frankly, I wish that I'd been prompted to do as part of my undergraduate experience. I was more concerned with fitting my learning into, what I thought the teacher wanted. But prior learning assessment, portfolio-based assessment at its best, is really about figuring out how your learning fits into what you want and what your goals are. And that strikes me as just an immensely more valuable process. So I do see a possibility and opening for institutions that feel that they have a great group of faculty that care a lot about students, that have close relationships with students, that have subject matter experts and curricular experts that have put a lot of thought and planning into what learning trajectories look like for various fields, to turn that into a flexible system, an open and interoperable system that can welcome students at various stages in their lives with various kinds of learning backgrounds, and help them turn their experiences into credits, into grades, and ultimately into degrees. But you could flip it all the way around, right? If students are really interested in, getting the learning however they can and then getting the credits, there is also a possibility for lightweight institutions that offer you, the least amount of help that you need at the lowest possible cost to get that learning and get that degree. So Straighter Line, the for-profit, is probably an example of that. Freshman year for $1,000. And 30 credits, and the help that you need available at a slightly higher cost than that. Assessment-based learning, outcomes-based learning. It's the opposite of sort of the holistic wraparound kind of, we're going to give you prior learning assessment and help you place it in. This is people who are at the beginning of the process or in the middle somewhere, and they need to supplement their learning experience and get a couple of grades here and there. Yet another really interesting direction, I think, that assessment and accreditation are going in is this idea, it connects this idea of a learning, learning networks is assessment by network, right? And the example that I use in the book, again, is Behance, which is a creative community for people with some kind of visual discipline, whether it's illustration, graphic design, photography. They upload their portfolio straight to the site. Those are voted up and down by members of the community, and companies like Apple and IDEO hire directly off of this site. So the people on the site don't need to go to art college because they have portfolios and a reputation. They're able to be made visible to a community, and the community hires them based on that. Is this going to completely replace diplomas? No. Is it going to be an important alternative to diplomas? Yes. Is it going to be an important adjunct to diplomas? I think absolutely. I don't think anybody's going to be able to succeed in the 21st century without participating in some kind of community like this, where their achievements are made visible to a community, their reputation is able to move beyond a name on a transcript and actually stand up and stand out for itself. And I think that, you know, this is something for career services offices to think about. How do you get beyond, you know, the resume, the endless resume, you know, resume writing and job hunting tips, and actually encourage students to connect what makes them motivated and passionate in the classroom and make that into something that's going to be attractive to an employer and to people that will help them make their dreams come true. Another really interesting aspect of open accreditation. A lot of you may have heard of or may be curious about the open badges movement. I think where the portfolio-based learning, the reputation networks, again, is a holistic kind of model. This is the really portable, modular kind of model. This is the idea of you know, rewards for learning that takes place in real-world contexts on networks. And then the badge would be portable. It would be something that is transparent, that's linked to a specific achievement. I think, you know, what's most interesting about this is not any particular instance of badging, because we see badging in lots of different contexts, you know, some of it more game-like and some of it more serious. But what's interesting is the recognition that there's a need for something, you know, below the level of the bachelor's degree that allows us to recognize, or the associate's degree, that allows us to recognize a specific kind of learning. And, you know, again, you could say that the nation's nonprofit associations are way ahead on this. There's, you know, thousands of designations for learning, and by some measurements, the Georgetown Center on Education and the Economy says that 73% of post-secondary learning takes place outside the university system already, right? And this is workplace training, this is Chubb's Institute, this is Microsoft certification. We already have a very large informal learning system, and badges is just kind of a new gloss, a new spin on an old model. But it has that, you know, that little bit of new Web 2.0 transparency and interoperability that might allow us to break through and make these kinds of things visible. And the ultimate goal of this, of course, is multiple pathways to success and a recognition of diversity of means of learning and styles of learning and things that are valuable to learn throughout our entire life cycle, because this is also about the perpetual learning that needs to go on in order for people to participate in the job market. So, you know, I posit and I frame, you know, again, framing the question and putting out the question that for the challenges that higher education is facing in the 21st century, there are responses along the lines of openness. And I think what's most difficult in thinking about these, it's just that we're trying to replace something that is so iconic and so mythic in our minds, a single vision of a path of what a university must be and can be and should be, that every college and every university has aspired to for so long. You know, there's been just, you know, Kevin Carey at Education Sector likes to say this, you know, the problem is that everybody has wanted to be Harvard. And the solution, I think, lies in the recognition that there are so many different ways not only for students to be successful, but also for institutions to be successful. No one model, no one idea that I presented to you today is going to be the answer. But in a diversity of models and a diversity of ideas that allows individuals to pursue their idea of the best life, I think a collective set of answers lies. And of course, a new set of questions, which is what our goal always is, I think, for those of us who love education. So I'm going to hit it there, and I'm going to take some questions from you. Thank you. I'm going to beg that if you're thinking about whether I have a question or whether I have a comment, I'd like to hear questions first. Comments maybe we can take after. Yes.
It seems like the model that you're talking about really requires people who are sort of actively participating and making strong decisions about where they're moving forward, et cetera. What do you think the K-12 educational system is going to need to do to make and turn out students that can do what you're talking about?
Okay, so I'm talking about a lot of different models, not just one model. And I agree with you that what it requires of students is a little bit different from what we're emphasizing now. Very different in some cases. Very, very different. There's a giant disconnect between, you know, NCLB and the emphasis on standards and standardized testing and the kinds of independent thinking and innovative thinking that are actually required for success in the 21st century. I don't think that's any secret. The good news about that, I think, is that, I mean, allowing more free and open play for students to really discover their passion, like the kind of learning that goes on in kindergarten, is actually a great model for what students need to be doing in post-secondary education. So if we can figure out a way to carve out a little bit more time for that, I think we'll be on the right track.
Hi, my name is Cable Green. I'm the Director of Global Learning for Creative Commons.
Hi.
So hello. First, thank you for emphasizing that open license is a core part of the OER definition. It's something we often forget. We think about it as just being free, but it's the legal rights to be able to change things, which are core. So my question is, as governments around the world are starting to adopt open policies when public funds are used to produce something, especially research materials or educational resources, public policies that are starting to come online require that there be an open license on those materials. We're seeing this in Brazil, in Poland, the Department of Department of Education and Labor here in the United States and others. So the question is, should publishers, existing business structures that currently sell us knowledge and information be threatened by that, or with proper open licensing, say a CC BY license where they can take it and modify it, is there an opportunity there for them? And should we care about that? Should we partner with those folks, or should we look to those massive amount, the tens of billions of dollars of resources that are coming online to do this, to look at new models?
Well, you're asking me to go really close to giving people business advice, which I don't want to do. I think that publishing companies are attacking this issue with a variety of strategies. One is to obfuscate the distinction between open license and non-open license materials. Another one is to introduce a lot of digital stuff and say, hey, this is in the cloud, you know, it's free until we say it's not, and isn't that great? And sort of just obscure the issue in people's minds. Accepting CC BY licenses and rewarding creators, as you know, companies like Fast Flat World Knowledge are trying to do, represents a better path. And the question is whether people who really, and publishers have a lot of experience in creating, attractive, easily packageable, good materials, which you know shouldn't be overlooked. So I can see that being a great third way, a great compromise way, if people who produce educational content are really savvy about what they want to do. But I don't see why people who care a lot about open license shouldn't pursue multiple strategies as well, if the people who want to eradicate open licenses are pursuing multiple strategies. So do it with public money if you can get public money. Do it with nonprofit money. I mean, my book is free, but it has a copyright from Gates Foundation, but it's still able to be reproduced and shared by people anywhere. The copyright is sort of this weird, meaningless fiction. So do it the way that you can do it if you want to get stuff shareable.
I think a lot of what you're talking about, in some ways, if you want to, tailor your own education, go online, find things, you need sort of a skill set already in digital media literacy. Mm-hmm. So it's like, this is a great idea, but you sort of already have to be at a certain threshold to take advantage. So how do you sort of make this available to those who don't already have those skills?
Yeah, great question. I think that people who care about this should direct their energies towards scaffolding this stuff as much as possible and emphasizing it as being something that is needs. It's a need to know. It's not a nice to know for students, whatever their level of resources. So I think a really great example of that I read about in the EduPunks Guide is LearnerWeb, which is a national program. It's in 8 states. It is a place to create open personal learning plans. There's personal learning plans on the site to choose from. And the plans will tell you about the type of people that they're trying to serve. The plans include get a GED, learn English, get an associate's degree. adult basic literacy skills. Learning how to read is one of them. So LearnerWeb is placed in adult literacy centers and in schools and in hubs for students who are returning to the education system after a long absence. And the way that it works is that you have a mentor within the system, a mentor online, who you also meet with in person. So there's a kind of emporium model. You go to a computer lab and there's someone walking around to help you. And the students learn the digital literacy alongside the skills, but they learn it within a framework of, this is my plan, these are my goals, I'm able to get the resources that I need to help me with this. And they're learning, the learning can be shared across the network so people can see other people's plans and other steps that they've taken, so there's collaboration as well. And this is a really great example to me of, you know, let digital do what digital can do, let free do what free can do, and use your resources for the people that really need it.
I was wondering if you knew, a lot of what you're talking about really depends on having skilled professionals, skilled teachers to facilitate these activities. And do you know if this is being incorporated into teacher education programs? Are teachers getting this kind of exposure to open content resources or these kind of pedagogies in current programs?
I mean, I don't know what the proportion is. I know that there's a lot of interest among the teacher education community in this because I hear from them all the time, and I think there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of teachers on Twitter. There's a lot of teachers, you know, trying to participate and learn a lot about these tools. And there are a lot of people like Creative Commons trying to reach out to teachers because, you know, they realize this. So, It's been a pretty good time, I think, for people who want to become public school teachers. You know, Teach for America has been the top hirer at some Ivy League institutions over the last couple of years as the economy has tanked. And there's a little bit of glamour on teaching and public school teaching. And I think that getting teachers connected to the latest technical tools and skills and just having a generation of people in the classroom that are comfortable with this kind of stuff innately can go a long way toward transforming the experience in the classroom. Sure. Yeah, you, then you. Yeah.
So I was looking at the American school system, and I know that, and it's often been stated, that we based our school system off of a factory model, which is kind of true and kind of false. Mm-hmm. I don't want to get myself in trouble already. I'm good at doing that. But what I was looking at was, as we've transformed ourselves into a knowledge economy, it would seem that the work that we are doing is more based on that distributed and collaborative and peer-driven learning. So looking at that, I mean, I think that in order to prepare our students for this new world, we need to start at the bottom. We need to start actually way back down, as you said, with kindergarten. Because it's like, we got kindergarten right. Kindergarten's good. Play and learn while you play. And then we change it around and say, okay, now everybody listens to the teacher, and the teacher does everything, and you just listen. And all of a sudden, all the kids get confused. And, you know, somebody made a comment about how in third grade, the third grade teacher's voice, you know, that gets everybody to sort of straighten up and pay attention. Well, that's that moment where we stop playing and learning. And that's that moment that turns off so many children. That's that moment that we went over to the factory model, you could say. So I look at that and I think, well, if we're going to re-tier this and we want to make, you know, and we want to sort of make a do-it-yourself university or more driven society to prepare ourselves for the knowledge work that we do in the future, we're going to have to start from the bottom up. Mm-hmm. That seems to be what I guess you're saying, but I wonder, there's a danger to that. How do we accredit that? How do we get people thinking along the lines of, you know, or giving them the ability to be accredited in that situation? Because they did correspondence courses in the USSR, and it didn't work out so well.
Right. So I think badges are a huge part of that, because badges are directed at informal learning, and learning as play, and they have a very game-like element to them. So the more that interfaces with the traditional education and assessment procedures, the more the two sides kind of become visible to each other. Because what we really need to do is kind of surface the learning that goes on after school And the whole landscape, the city where the students are learning, whether it's a park, a museum, a library, you know, in their bedroom with their friends, make all of that available and make that all of that recognizable. And, you know, there's a danger to that because, you know, as soon as you put a framework on that, you make it less fun and you make it less exploratory. But I think that's the point of that movement. Yes. Oh, this is the last question. Gosh. Okay. You can always ask some questions on Twitter. Yeah. Great. Okay. I didn't really specifically talk about the tenure system for good reason. But I think that there's going to have to be a different way to protect the free play of ideas, basically. You know, I think that what in reality protects the free play of ideas is a certain level of civility that goes on in the world of discourse. And that civility is fostered by a lot of these things that we're talking about relationships between people, transparency and collaboration and finding a common cause. And I think that you know, that's the freedom that I rely on as a journalist. And I see that being something to be defended, even if I can't put my finger on what the definition of it is right now. Okay.
Hannah, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Excellent.
You can hear more podcasts by visiting us online at www.educause.edu/podcasts. Thanks for listening.